Well, after a long time in the planning, we've finally managed to sort out our VI parenting section for the podcast. So I'd like to welcome, as well as Joe, we've got Yvette. Hi, Yvette.
Hi, Michael.
Hello, Linda.
Hi, Michael.
Hi, Jane.
Hello.
And hi, Gary.
Hi there.
Well, you know me and Joe, so what we'll do is we'll just let each person introduce themselves. So, Linda, do you want to just say a little bit about yourself, how many children you've got, when you were at school, that sort of thing?
Surely. Hi, I'm Linda Fitchett, known to most of the St Vincent's people as Bernadette Riley. I was at school in 1960 and went through to 1971. I've been married for 33 years, and I have two grown-up children, my daughter Sonia and my son Philip. Sonia has full sight and Philip is visually impaired. I go to work, and I'm a very happy person.
Great, thank you very much. And over to you, Yvette.
I'm Yvette Hill. People at St Vincent's will remember me as Yvette Forrest. I was at St Vincent's from 1980 until 1990. After that, I went to mainstream school and then on to university. I'm married to Ian. I've got three children, Christopher, who's five, Emily, three, and Jessica, who's one. And I work part-time 3 days a week as a civil servant.
Right, Jane, and over to you.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jane Redfern Gray. I was at St Vincent's between 1979 and 1981. And I'm married to Gary, who you're going to hear in a little while. And we've got three children. We've got Joshua, who's 18. Rosanna, who's 15, and Nathaniel, who's 4.
And over to you, Gary.
Hi, well, my name's Gary Redfern Gray, obviously married to Jane. I have never been to St Vincent's, but I've heard a lot about it. Same three children, obviously, and but I do work for R&IB for my sins.
Right, well, initially the idea to cover VI parenting was Linda's. But the others have kindly agreed to step in and help out. So we basically, the idea is that we wanted people to kind of know that we can do it just the same as anybody else. Well, that's what we try to do. I'm going to go around and just talk about how you feel, firstly, about being a parent, I think. What's important to you, maybe what you've done differently. We're all going to have probably different amounts of sight. For me, I'm totally blind, and everybody knows I've just got Jodie, who features on the podcast regularly as well, and she's fully sighted. But some of us have got visually impaired children and some of us haven't. So if we start this time with Yvette, do you want to tell us a little bit about your experience, Yvette?
I am partially sighted, but I'm technically registered blind, although my near vision isn't too bad and my distance vision is reasonable enough. All of my children are fully sighted, and which is beginning to come in handy as my five-year-old is becoming my very own sign reader, bus number teller, and so he's beginning to have his uses. I've got enough sight to push a pram, which is useful. I was very apprehensive about it at first and thought I'd be running the pram into lampposts and things, but thus far the children have been uninjured and still live to tell the tale.
That's always good.
Yeah.
Okay, so now moving on to Jane. Do you want to tell us a little bit about your experiences, Jane?
Okay, yeah. I think it's fair to kind of say that Gaz and I discussed kind of whether or not we wanted to have kids, and we kind of came to the conclusion that if we didn't, then we would kind of just get on with our lives as we were, even though we were both visually impaired. And so we thought, well, if we can get on okay, then there's no reason why we shouldn't have kids. Yeah, that was the first kind of discussion that we had. But there was always kind of thoughts in the back of our mind that, like, oh, gosh, you know, how are we going to deal with this and I hope everything's going to be okay. But then we kind of thought, well, why shouldn't it be? You know, we're quite independent people anyway. So we kind of thought about, considered lots of different aspects, really. So, yeah, that was our thinking from the outset, wasn't it, Gaz?
Yeah, it was. And I think when we were just thinking about the whole should we, shouldn't we have children, and obviously you think, well, if the child is VI, will that make a difference? Well, we're very used to dealing with being VI, obviously. If the child's a different sort of disability, well, what should we do about that? I just thought we just get on and just cross those bridges if they arose. And I think for me, the main thing was about, it was more the parenting side. I mean, I think when you have your first child, you're thinking, how's this going to affect our lives? And, you know, I hope I'm a good parent. And it was, for me, more about being a parent than the actual issue of being a VI parent. And I just knew that, you know, when children come into our lives, they'll just have to come into our world and live in our world. And obviously that part of that is about being VI. And but I didn't worry overly much around that.
Yeah.
No, I'm certainly, we had all the questions, you know, when I was pregnant with Joshua, we had everything, you know, people making all kinds of comments and everything from, oh, are you going to have somebody living with you 24/7 now then once you've had the baby, right through to, oh, you'll be absolutely fine, you know, we know you really well and I think you'll make great parents and you'll be absolutely fine. But it was strange that the range of viewpoints that we had to listen to, and sometimes you just really had to grit your teeth with some of the viewpoints that people had.
Yeah, definitely. And what about you, Linda?
Well, my experience was that when we got married, my husband and I, we wanted children, and I actually had my daughter very quickly. We'd both had counselling before we got married, and I was actually told that my condition was just for me alone and it wouldn't be passed on, and I went with that thought, and I had my daughter, and she was born with full sight, and I was in a position when I had my daughter Sonia, I was able to push the pram and see her and look after her, although I did have a health visitor that used to come to the house. And I think she was desperate to find some way where she could imply that I couldn't manage. And the one thing she picked up on was that I bottle fed Sonia. And when I used to put the bottle to her mouth, I just used to gently feel her mouth to make sure it was going where it should. And she was quite horrified and reckoned that I would be passing on my germs to my daughter. So that was a little bit of an obstacle to overcome. I basically just decided that I'd have to just carry on and not take too much notice of any of this. And as I say, I was okay with looking after Sonia. It was absolutely fine. And then when Philip came along, he was 2, and I was diagnosed with end-stage glaucoma, and my vision went quite quickly. So I actually had no vision by the time Philip was 2. So the pram pushing days were over by then. And then the other thing that we had to contend with is that Philip was VI himself. He had the same problem as me, which although I was quite happy to deal with it, it was a bit of a shock at first. However, we just got on with it all, and I basically felt that sort of echoed Gary's sentiment, really, that VI wasn't really an issue because we were all living with it anyway, and Philip would be okay with it as well. And he had useful vision up until the age of 9, and then unfortunately, as a result of cataract operations, he had scar tissue problems. Scar tissue is basically hemorrhaged, and he was then totally blind at the age of 9. So It was quite traumatic, but absolutely fantastic. I wouldn't have had it any other way. I loved having the children. I adored them as babies. loved them growing up and still absolutely adore them even now, and likewise adore my 4-year-old granddaughter.
That's fantastic. I've got a really controversial question for you all now, and you don't have to answer it, but it's from what you've all said that's just brought this to the forefront of my mind. Had you been told that your children would definitely have been visually impaired if you'd had children, would it have stopped you having children, or would you still have gone ahead and had children? And you don't have to answer it, Jane, first.
I absolutely would have gone ahead regardless, and this is controversial because, in a sense, as visually impaired parents, it might have been easier if your kids have been visually impaired as well, because there's lots of things that your kids, I mean, our three kids are all fully sighted. And in some ways, and I know it sounds awful, but in some ways it possibly would have been easier in some ways for us, not for them. I wouldn't have wished it on them at all, but it possibly in some ways could have been easier, I suppose, if you want to be controversial.
Yeah.
But it wouldn't
yeah.
have made any difference. It wouldn't have made any difference to us whatsoever. And whether they'd been visually impaired or fully sighted, or, you know, one of them visually impaired and one of them fully sighted, wouldn't have made any difference whatsoever.
Right. And Gary, I'm assuming you're in the same.
No, I don't disagree with that. No, I do agree with it. I would have been more worried if I'd had a deaf child. I think I would have found that particularly, you know, a lot more difficult.
Yeah.
Because of not being able to see the sign language and things. But, it would have made absolutely no difference, you know, had the child been visually impaired. And in fact, some of the problems that I felt is the whole dealing with this. Because, I mean, obviously you want your children to fully participate in every aspect of obviously being a child, and but not being able to watch TV with them. And that was one of the things that really... and I still, what with Nathaniel now, and he's only 4. So not being able to say, look over there at that bird, or look over there, or what's that? And, you know, that's on the TV, or what's that over there? Mm. And so I kind of feel that he's kind of missed out on that kind of interaction. And I know we can't do that. You know, you just have to get on and do it in other ways. But
yeah.
I think with them being sighted, that gives a different set of challenges, really.
And Linda, I think you answered that before, didn't you, really? But yeah, go on.
I wouldn't have had it any other way. I would have, even if I'd known that I could have had, you know, the kids may have been VI, I would have still wanted to have them, would never have made any difference. And I've got to say that I totally agree with Jane and Gary that... I've got such a special bond with Philip, and I think it is because he's VI, because we can share that, you know, I share different things with Sonia, but with Philip I've got such a special bond, and I believe that is because both he and I are VI. So, you know, I think it has its advantages as well as its disadvantages, and I wouldn't have had it any other way.
And Yvette, how do you feel?
I feel the same as the others. If I'd have known one of my children would have been visually impaired and it was a certainty, it wouldn't have changed my mind about having children. I will say it was a relief when they were born and I found out that they hadn't inherited my condition. But if they had have done, you know, it would have just been something that we would have dealt with. And when we thought about it before we sort of talked about having children, the only thing that I feel I haven't been able to do in life is drive. And, you know, if that's all my children couldn't do and everything else is open to them, then, you know, I, you know, thought that was, you know, I don't feel sort of that I've missed out on life because of it.
Right. No, that's brilliant. Thanks. Because you didn't have to answer that at all, any of you, but...
Joe, do you want to answer that question?
Me? Gosh, well, I knew that my right from sort of being a child that my eye condition wasn't hereditary, so it wasn't really. I mean, we had Jodie's eyes checked just as a matter of course when she was born, but I pretty much knew that my eye condition wasn't hereditary, so it wasn't something we really had to think about, I suppose. would it have made a difference? Do you know, I don't know. I'd like to say it wouldn't have made a difference, because I guess who probably makes the best parents for a VI child, a VI person, I suppose, because we understand it. And you get all the fights as well, don't you? But I don't know, really.
Just one thing I'll just comment as well, because obviously we've not got children, me and Karen. And not really a conscious decision. It was one of the things where we just never got around to it. But when I was about 19, my sort of mother came home one day and says, "I'm pregnant," which is a bit of a shock, really, you know, considering I was an only child for 20 years. And I suppose a little bit like, obviously, as a parent, I suppose, is my fear was obviously my brother or sister at the time, I didn't know what it was going to be, were they going to be visually impaired? And that was the one real fear I had while my mum was pregnant. And they both turned out, well, normal as a brother of mine could or a sister of mine could. But, you know, that was a fear as a brother.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's always, if I'm being honest, I think there's always that feeling that you don't want to. If Jodie had been born with a sight problem, and it obviously, I knew, as again, from my parents were told from me being pretty much a toddler that I would lose my sight eventually. That was a given. So I think I'd have felt a bit guilty, I suppose, if I'd have passed that on to Jodie. And I'm, you know, I suppose for that, I'm very grateful that she's fully sighted. So I think if I'm being honest, then that probably would have been one of my feelings about it. So, yeah. Shall we go on to a lighter note? We must all have funny stories about parenting. Well, I'm assuming we do. And we must have all been asked the questions about what's the hardest thing. And I can remember being in a pub at once, and it was somebody very random who I didn't know that well, and just said to me, "What's the hardest thing? You know, oh, how do you do it? How can you be a parent when you're blind? And what's the hardest thing?" And I just looked at her and said, "Well, you try feeding a baby Weetabix at 7 o'clock in the morning, you know, when you..." You know, and so what would you say is the hardest thing? So let's start with Yvette. What's one of the hardest things that you've had to do, or a funny story, something like that?
I don't know.
Put you on the spot.
Getting up with my three every day is probably the hardest thing. probably the hardest thing is when your child runs off and they're out of sight a lot quicker than they would be for you, than they would be for somebody else.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, you're in a supermarket, you turn around and your two-year-old has vanished and, you know, they're gone. And you're like, where are they? But you can't see them. You know, they could be 10 feet away.
Yeah.
That probably is the hardest thing that I've ever dealt with, my son wandering off in the middle of Marks and Spencer's when he was two. Fortunately, a kind lady saw him wandering off on his own and brought him back. Some mad woman with empty pram walking around going, "Where's he gone?"
What about you, Jane? And Gary, I guess, do it as a couple if you want to, if that's easier.
Okay. Talking about the kids running away, it reminds me of a story that I was walking to school with Rosanna. Was about, I think she was about two in the buggy, and Joshua would have been five, and I was walking to school with another mum who had a daughter who's the same age as Joshua, and then we joined some other mums on the way because it was about a half hour walk to get from our area to school. And halfway through the walk, Joshua and his friend disappeared, and we kind of assumed that, oh my goodness, they probably run ahead to school, but we didn't know. So we were in a panic, dashing to school. When we did get to the playground, they were both there, quite happy, blissfully unaware of what they'd done. And I didn't say a lot to Joshua because I didn't want to tell him off and then leave him alone at school for the day upset. But when he did come home, you know, I had to sit down and explain the reasons why he shouldn't run off. And actually, I banned him from watching TV for a week and I banned him from having any sweets for a week and I banned him from having any dessert for a week.
This is a cruel mother.
I'm having to emphasise that he must never ever do that again. And I thought, you know, shouting at him is not going to do a great deal of good, but I thought, you know, he needs to, even at the tender age of 5, I need to explain why he mustn't do that again. But I just wanted to make an impact and make him realise that he mustn't do that. But it was harder for me to be disciplined to carry it out for a week than it was for him, I'm sure. But yeah, I can understand. That is really difficult when they do run off. But I think the one thing for me, even bringing up 3 children, the one thing for me that's been the hardest, that has literally brought me to the point of tears, and you're going to laugh about this, the most hard thing, head lice.
Head lice.
Yes. My goodness, that's not good.
We seemed to go through a period of about 2 years when both the children were coming home with head lice, and every time one of the children ran out of the school, ran out of the classroom, and I felt this narrow strip of paper in my hand. I thought, you don't need to read that to me. I know exactly what it is. But the sheer kind of disruption of constantly combing and combing and combing. We spent literally, I don't know, so much money on solutions.
A fortune on treatments.
Yep.
And the thing is, you can't see whether your children have got head lice or not, or whether whether since now you've treated them, they don't have it anymore. So you just get these notes that somebody in, you know, it's like the lottery, it could be you, could be your child.
You know what I mean?
Oh, it's so frustrating.
Yeah, it is.
And we spent pounds and pounds on all these different sorts of combs, ones that would bleep and ones that would do this and do that, and none of them worked.
No.
And I used to spend hours queuing up at the health centre to say, I've had a letter, I've treated my children, please could you check that I've got rid of everything? But, you know, there seem to be always, you know, you're always going to get it, whoever you are and whichever school you're at, there's always going to be some parent who doesn't really bother, and then you end up in the same old position again. And that situation, more than anything else, literally brought me to the point of tears.
Yeah, I can understand that. What about you, Linda?
Well, I must say, I do echo the sentiment about the head lice. Of course, that was quite a big issue. I used to always get my mum to have a look when she came, just to check. I mean, they were constantly having their heads checked, poor kids. But one of the things I do remember is that Philip, at the age of 12 months, was actually having to wear glasses, and we used to have to tie them on with an elastic band at the back so they would be secure on his head, and he hated them, and if we went out he would inevitably pull them off and drop them somewhere, and I would have people knocking at the door and handing me these glasses. Did you know your son dropped his glasses halfway along the road? So it was a real nightmare trying to keep him with his glasses on. Yeah, I just sort of echo what everyone else has said, really. The everyday things that every sighted person perhaps takes for granted, you know, things where you really do need vision to be able to deal with. Some of that could be a bit tricky, but we always seem to find our way around these things as VI people. And I think apart from, as I say, constant loss of glasses in my house, things weren't too bad, really.
Is there any advice that any of you would give to would-be parents out there that perhaps are thinking, should I, shouldn't I? I remember a young woman asking me once, you know, just the simple things, how do you go about, you know, with a pram, or, you know, feeding and just the general things. And is there anything you would say, or would you just be generally encouraging? What would you, you know, what would your advice be, or anything like that to anybody out there who's umming and ahhing about it, or perhaps thinking, will I be able to do it, or will I be, you know, useless at it? Because I guess we all go through that, don't we? So I can't remember who we're up to, so we'll go with Yvette.
I would say just go for it. Most things you'll find a way round, and the others you'll just fudge and find your own way.
when you talked about the Weetabix at 7 in the morning, what I've done with mine is something called baby-led weaning, where you don't do any spoon feeding at all. And what you do is, from when they're about 6 months, you just plonk chunks of food on their high chair and you leave them to pick it up and eat it themselves, which saves trying to find a mouth with a loaded spoon and then they flick it all everywhere in it. And it's messy, and you have the opposite problem of you end up crawling around the floor trying to find what they've discarded over the side. But that I did find made my life easier. And it also meant that when you went to eat out and things, you could just give them whatever you were having. And if you got stranded somewhere, then you could just give them something rather than having to sort of hunt out for a jar of baby food. You could just say, here you go, have a banana or have something.
Right, that's interesting. What got you onto that, Yvette?
My son, I did spoon feed, which ended up being a process of him turning his head away and screaming at me. And my friend had done this with their twins, and she said, oh, you should give it a go. And got to my second child, and I thought, oh, I've got nothing to lose. So I gave it a go, and it was so, so much easier. And yeah. I find that both my daughters I've done it with, and they are so much less fussy than my son was, because they've just been used to being given whatever we're having for dinner. They're just given from the word go. Sometimes minus a tomato-y sauce. So their dinner might have been, if they were having a pasta thing, it might have been taken out the pan before the tomato sauce got added to it. So they might have just had pasta and vegetables rather, but that was mainly so that I didn't have to get it out their hair afterwards. But it did make sort of life easy trying to sort of get a spoonful of yogurt into their mouth.
Yeah. Jane, Gary?
Yeah, with the feeding, I kind of developed everybody develops their own way, don't they? Because, feeding a baby in a high chair is a real messy business. And I tended to use, what you can do, you can buy, instead of buying just a normal bib, what you can buy now is it's almost like an overall, really, so that you put their arms through and it fastens around the back so that they're completely kind of covered. So I used those because they were easy just to take them off and chuck them in the washing machine. But it meant that when you took it off, the clothes stayed clean.
That's a really good idea.
Rather than just a standard bib. Mm. The other thing I did was I had a set of little cloth, and I used to keep a little dampened cloth on the corner of the table of the high chair. And then what I used to do, because I'm right-handed, I used to take my left hand and kind of cup baby's chin in my left hand with my thumb just underneath their bottom lip. And I would use that as a kind of a guide for putting the spoon in their mouth. And then obviously, if I took my hand away because it had got a bit of food on it, just take my left hand away and just wipe it on the edge of the cloth each time so that it was clean when I put my thumb back under his chin again.
Yeah.
And just develop that kind of method, really. And then you find as baby gets a bit older, they naturally, as you put the spoon towards them, you find that their head moves forward towards the spoon eventually. They learn that trick very quickly.
Yeah.
They do if they like the food. But when they don't. So Joshua was the worst for, I love the sweet stuff, I hate the savoury stuff. So he'd be turning his head, and then once he'd got the spoon, he'd be spitting it everywhere. And, just nightmare. Thing is, that's going to happen. Just deal with it. It's going to happen, whether you're blind or not. And I think, you don't want to think, oh, how will I be able to do X? How will I be able to feed my child or change a nappy or whatever? And changing nappies, oh, boy, that's another one. And particularly, I'm talking about hard things. Changing, and what I think my pet hate is changing a nappy in public. When you know that people are going to be staring at you, thinking, oh, how's this blind man going to be able to do this?
Yeah.
And if it's a really bad one, it's really not good. But, you just have to go for it because, these things are going to come up. You're going to get over them. You're going to find workarounds. I mean, I'd hate to think that you're not going to have something as wonderful as a child because you worried how you were going to look after it.
because that's normally you don't.
Somebody from
church, a friend of ours, he asked me once, he said, Jane, how does a blind person change a nappy? And I paused and then I just looked at him, smiled and said, carefully.
Yes, with an awful lot of baby wipes and wet cotton wool. What about you, Linda?
Well, I think just do what we do best in the way that we do it best, and you'll make absolutely brilliant parents. I think don't let anybody put you off. You know, people do want to watch you doing things. You are a bit of a novelty to them if you can't see. But just forget all that and just do what you want to do in the way that you do it, and I'm sure everything will be brilliant.
Do you know, I was just thinking about something that happened to me. My sister-in-law is fully sighted, and she hadn't had children, and her and Rob's brother were planning on having a family. And I remember Jodie was still in nappies, and she actually asked me, she said, can I come upstairs with you, Joe? She said, and can I change Jodie's nappy? She said, and can you show me how to do it? And I went, yeah. And it made my day, because I thought, actually, somebody sighted is actually asking me, can I help them? And it was nice, because there was no, you know, it wasn't that whole thing, how do you do it? You're blind, blah, blah, blah. And I think that's it, isn't it? Just get in there and do it and find ways around it. And, you know, and don't miss out on having something as wonderful as a child, because people tell you you can't, or because you think you can't, because you probably and invariably can.
And do it better than the rest, no doubt.
Yeah. Is there anything else before we finish that anybody wants to add or bring up, or, you know, that you think would be interesting for anybody or helpful?
I'm sure we've all got funny stories that we can tell. I'm sure we've all got them about things that have happened to us. I mean, I've got absolutely tons of them. I remember one day when Josh was about two, and I came home with a load of shopping, and he was wanting to help me put the stuff away. So no problem. I handed him tins of things to put in the cupboard, and we did it all together. It was all great fun until the next morning when I thought, Weetabix for breakfast. Where's that? And I searched for it every single cupboard, couldn't find it. Came to the conclusion that I'd left it on the belt on the at the till at the supermarket. And it wasn't until about two or three days later, when I opened the freezer to look for some ice cream, that I found the Weetabix. Thanks to my little helper, bless him. Yeah. And then another time when he was about, I think he must have been about two again, when I was stood in the bus queue to come home at the bus station, and we'd called at the shop to buy a bar of chocolate or something, and the lady in front of me turned to Josh in his pram and said, oh, are you enjoying your orange juice, darling? And I thought, orange juice? And he'd helped himself to two cartons of orange juice from the shelf in the shop.
I've actually got quite a funny one as well. When Sonia was very tiny, she used to like to open all the cupboards in the kitchen and play with the pans and the pots and everything like that, which was absolutely fine. And I remember one afternoon, she got herself in there and all the usual things came out and all the lids of the saucepans, and she was happily playing with them and talking to them and everything. So I popped into the lounge and quickly got the Hoover out and whipped around, as you do. Came back and she was really, really quiet, just sitting there as quiet as anything. And then I suddenly noticed that she was chomping on something. I thought, well, there's nothing here. What on earth's going on? So I opened her mouth, and there I found a handful of cat biscuits. Lift up the cat bowl from the kitchen floor when I went out to do the hoovering, and of course she'd obviously seen it and helped herself to the cat food. Sitting there chomping away on them.
Oh no.
Yeah, so I think it was totally my fault for leaving them on the floor, of course, but obviously she thought that would be quite nice for her afternoon snack.
Because they're going to do that, I remember Rosanna, she was in a playpen, and, you know, she used to like it in the playpen, a load of toys in there, but we had left a tub of Sudocrem near the playpen,
And she'd managed to get it in. I'm not sure whether she'd got it through the bars or whatever. I don't know how she got it in there, but we didn't realise this. And that's the thing. You're not going to, you can't see what they're doing. You know, actually, the fact of life, you know, you just have to get on with it. But
yeah.
Man, she had covered everything herself and the rest of the planet in this pseudogram. And of course, it's so hard to get off. It's just, So, you know, they're gonna do this. They're gonna do this stuff, and it's all just part of the. That's all part of the fun most of the time, I think.
yeah, most.
I thought I didn't have a funny story. You've just reminded me. I was in the kitchen getting dinner ready just before I went to pick my eldest up from school, and my 3-year-old came running in, and she goes, "It's snowing, mummy." And I turned around. What do you mean it's snowing? And she opened her hand, and she had 2 handfuls of beans from the bean bag in her hand.
Oh.
And then I said, "Where'd you get these from, the bean bag?" "It's snowing, mummy, like on Peppa Pig." I went into the living room. There were beans everywhere. I did my best to tidy them up. I had about 10 minutes until school, and then when we got on the way back from school, I said to my 5-year-old, "Mummy's got a really important job for you. When we get home, I'm going to give you the Hoover and see how many bits of beans you can find." Thinking 1-year-old beans, not a good combination. So I was petrified of the baby scooping up these beans and eating them. 3-year-old thought it was hysterical, and the 5-year-old, bless him, actually went round and hoovered up all the beans before my husband got home from work. He's like, never turn your back on a toddler.
No. Fatal.
Another interesting thing was, we asked over dinner one night, because we've never actually talked with the children about me being visually impaired, and we had a conversation with the children over dinner, and we asked the 5- and 3-year-old, "Can mummy and daddy see well?" And they both came out with, "Mummy can see well, but daddy can't because he wears glasses." Now, my husband is fully sighted. it just goes to show that so they haven't picked up on anything yet, and their friends haven't sort of said anything, you know, in school to my son either. So I just found that really interesting. You know, he's got to 5 and he hasn't noticed, you know, that I'm visually impaired, which I thought was quite interesting, that, you know, because daddy wears glasses, daddy can't see very well. And they both, probably my daughter was following suit with my son, but that was, you know, their reasoning at their age. So, you know, they clearly haven't seen sort of any difference really between what mummy can do and what daddy can do.
Oh, that's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else? Anybody?
Can I just say a little bit about maybe about schooling as well? Because,
yeah, of course you can.
With Philip, he, obviously being visually impaired, he actually went to mainstream. I now actually teach in mainstream. So I've actually experienced my son going to mainstream, teaching in mainstream, and also my going away to special education. My feeling is that, you know, special education, mainstream, they suit some children, they don't suit others. Philip was very lucky. He was able to go through mainstream and just work alongside his sighted peers in the way that both my husband and I wanted him to. And I think, you know, that was brilliant because obviously he was in an education where, you know, what everybody was hoping he would be able to do. But don't let anybody force you as parents into doing anything you don't want to. If you genuinely feel that your child is going to be better off somewhere that, you know, they're going to benefit from, dig your heels in and say, you know, "No, I really don't want my child going to the school you're saying. I want to consider other options." I think the LEA tends to think that everybody wants to go to mainstream and that's what it's for and everybody should be there. But that isn't always the case. what works for one doesn't work for everybody. So, you know, be firm as a parent. Say what you want, not what they want you to say.
That's a good point. And we are actually, I think, in a future podcast, Michael will tell me on this, I think we're going to cover mainstream sort of versus specialist education. Not that it's a competition as such, but that, you know, to kind of talk about how different people cope in different environments and how some suit, you know, it might suit one person but won't necessarily suit another.
Something that happened last week that I found really interesting, actually. We went to Nathaniel's first parents' evening and we were talking about Nathaniel learning his letters. And I said that I got some magnetic letters that had also got Braille on them. And his teacher said to me, well, when you're spelling out the words for him, you know, just simple three-letter words or whatever, she said, do you make him touch the letters and feel them? I said, no, why do you ask that? She said, because when I'm teaching him to do his writing, when he's written it, he always puts his fingers across it to, as if he's feeling it as well. And I said, no, that's probably just because he's seen us read Braille. So we had a bit of a giggle about it. But I was explaining this to somebody that I teach, one of my students who is also totally blind. He has a six-year-old fully sighted son. And he said, that's amazing. He said, because when his son was only four and started at school and going through the same process, he did exactly the same thing.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
There is one thing that I was told by when we lived in Preston with a friend who used to do, you know, the spot checks on nurseries to see if they were up to standard and everything. And when she found out that I had Jodie, she said that in her experience, she would imagine that a visually impaired parent, their child would kind of begin to communicate sometimes more often, more quickly than a child who had a sighted parent. And I was a bit sceptical about this, and I've spoken to other VI parents about it, and we've kind of come to the conclusion that we think it's because we communicate more. Because I know when Jodie was little, everything I talked to her all the time, you know, I didn't point at anything for us, but, you know, and if she pointed, she had to communicate with me. And I think that is probably the case. I think I would agree with what she said, that Jodie began to communicate. I mean, she was counting and reading before a lot of people that I knew who were sighted and had sighted children.
I'd absolutely agree with that. I do think their vocabulary develops quicker because we're always talking to them.
Yeah, definitely.
And lots of people have always said, with all our three children, gosh, they're speaking really, really well, you know. And I think it's because we spend more time talking to them, and they're not allowed to just point at something. If they want something,
they have to ask,
they're not allowed to point at it.
Yeah.
They have to articulate themselves.
Yeah, that's it, isn't it? Yeah, that's definitely exactly right.
I noticed with my granddaughter, because obviously my daughter and her husband are both sighted parents, and I noticed that there is a difference between my granddaughter and my daughter. My granddaughter doesn't talk to me as much, despite the fact that I talk to her. She isn't as communicative, and I'm sure it is because they have such a lot of eye contact between the three of them that she forgets that she has to talk to me, and that she isn't allowed to point to things or nod at me or anything like that. But it's definitely there, you know, there is a difference. The sighted child tends to be quieter, I think, and you know, that those with VI parents.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I've really enjoyed it. Thanks ever so much for taking part.
It has. It's been fantastic. Really grateful for you, Linda, Yvette, Jane, and Gary for joining us, spending some time with us, and bringing a real insight as well. And we hope, you know, other potential or parents will get something out of this as well. And obviously, they'll have shared similar experiences.